The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
It's 4:32, so I'm going to go ahead and begin, and I'm going to ask you to bow your heads in prayer with me. Heavenly Father, thank you for this wonderful conference that we are a part of. Thank you for calling us to be here, and I especially thank you, Lord, for this group that you have brought to me today. I pray that you would be glorified and honored in all the things that I say. And Lord, you will get the glory. We praise you and we thank you for art and classical Christian education. Amen. My name is Lucinda Brown, and I am a teacher at Newberg's Veritas School. That's up in the Pacific Northwest in the state of Oregon. And I have been there, well, it's going on my 9th year of teaching there as an art teacher. And it was a pleasant surprise for me. I didn't expect I was going to become an art teacher after I finished art school, but I'm so happy that God directed me to classical Christian education and pulled it all together. So thank you for being here today with me, and I hope that I can give you some tips and ideas that will help make your job a little easier. Before I do, though, I have to share a little bit of the philosophy of classical Christian education as it applies to art itself, because there's really no point in me talking about practical ideas without doing that. I'm very passionate about the arts and Christ. It's such an amazing thing. I came upon this whole thing a little bit later in my life, and maybe that's why I'm so passionate about it. But we have a task as Christian teachers, specifically art teachers, and I think it's more important than we may even realize. Most people in our society, even within the church, haven't a clue that there's a direct connection between God and art. And that's amazing to me because God is, after all, the creator of the universe. But the average person probably understands that visual art is a powerful vehicle for communication. But most people, and even myself when I was younger, separate things into categories. Any areas of knowledge and skill. We have art over here and music over here. And we have our faith up here, you know. And a lot of people just don't make connections between it all. But we can find out more by checking into the Bible. And we can realize that there is a direct connection. And one of the ways that I learned about this that really opened my eyes was to read Francis Schaeffer's little book, Art and the Bible. And if you have never read this little book, oh, please do. You can actually get this. I'm hoping I can aim things the right way. You can get this book at Veritas Press, Amazon. This is one of the newer copies of it. I'm showing it to you upside down, aren't I? Is that better? Art and the Bible. Most people separate and categorize things, as I said. And Francis Schaeffer would call this relegating art to the fringe of life. And he goes on to explain that God doesn't have platonic relationships. He's sovereign over the whole man. We're made in his image, after all. And he's a creative God. So it goes to stand that he delights in our creativity. And I think that personally we're only trying to imitate our Father when we're creative and we make art and when we teach children to make art. The arts have been misunderstood, maligned, and misused for a very long time. We know that. But God is a God of redemption. And he's placed us in roles as art teachers in classical Christian schools because he is in the business of redemption. He has something going on in this world, and I'm very excited to be a part of that. And I hope that you are too. So we have the opportunity to pour God's truth about art into the minds and the hearts of these students that he's brought to us. that is an amazing area. You know, I went to, I attempted earlier on to go to seminary, and my goal was to become a worship arts pastor. And I was all ready to go, but about that time, I found myself working at Veritas School, and I realized that that was where I belonged. That was my mission field or my call to ministry, because I was being so much more effective in a classroom than in a small local church. And so I want to encourage you to think of what you're doing as a ministry in the worship arts, and you're part of a movement that God is doing all over the world. People are being called into this. So let's delight in what we're doing. We have many biblical references that back up this connection between God and the arts. Of course, we have the book of Genesis, you know, the creation. And we can read in the book of Exodus about the tabernacle and God's aim for that and his instructions to Moses. And we know that all of this was beautiful and good. So we can connect all of our philosophy right back to the scriptures. And then there's that constant connection for us to Philippians 4:8. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Out of our meditations come our expressions of art, whether it's music or dance, whatever it is. But for me personally, it's the visual arts. I'm assuming that's what you're here for. Well, we have a job ahead of us because a lot of people, like I said, even within the church, have a great misunderstanding about what art really is. It's kind of mysterious to some people. Don't you find that a lot of families even that I make connections with kind of have an idea that art's just over there somewhere? And well, I've had families come to me and say, we don't have any artistic genes in our family. And the children have had that idea passed on to them. And so I realize when I hear these things that I have some work to do because, you know, I have to show them, I have to tell them, we're made in God's image. God is creative. We're creative. And I'm delighted to tell you that I've even seen a student make a huge turnaround. She came in as a new sixth grader. She told me that they didn't have art genes in their family. And by the time she finished sixth grade, she realized she really can draw. And she had art in our student show, and she was very, very happy. And so were her parents. So that was a wonderful fruit of my labors. I just praise God for that. But the subject of art sometimes is kind of casual. People think that it's time for leisure, just nothing but self-expression. It's part of the world that's, you know, infiltrated into our families even. And we need to help people understand that art is a subject. It is something that we should take joy in, but yet we need to be thoughtful and we need to be focused. And we need to learn to do well. There is a very casual attitude about art. I think especially maybe I notice it because I'm on the West Coast and we're pretty casual out there. But when it comes to the arts, it seems like people just think you can do any old thing and it'll be beautiful or it's okay. But we need to teach that art can be that, but that isn't all it is. People need to learn to build skills. From the time they're children, we need to help them learn to help hold their pencils correctly and their paintbrushes and how to take care of their supplies and how to go about executing ideas and drawing from their imagination and being thoughtful and contemplative. So we want them to be joyful and happy, but yet we want to teach them to be self-controlling and to be determined and learn to do well. We need to raise the bar in a casual culture where anything goes. So we have a really important job. We observe, we learn, and we practice in the classroom. And in a classical Christian school, it should be more of a master and apprenticeship approach. We need to go back to that. Let's dive in the dumpster and pull that one out again. We don't play with our art supplies. How many of you art teachers have challenges at times with students just playing with their paint? Anybody? Yeah, I do that too. And I have to teach them that these are our tools, and we don't do that. We don't throw erasers. That's school property. I don't care how small it is. Things like that. We need to teach them to respect the tools that we've been given and be good stewards of them. But we're not having recess with crayons either. You know, when we come to art class, this is the subject, and we need to pay attention. We need to behave. We need to focus. I know a lot of art teachers have this attitude that we should let our students talk during art class and relax because the other academic classes are much more rigid and we just want them to have a break. Well, I understand that to a point, but at the same time, how can we teach them to think seriously about their subject if we have that attitude? And so I expect my students to behave in art class just as well as they do in their other classes. And I have methods of discipline, things just like other teachers. And it's challenging at times, I admit, but we have to keep working at it. Art should be joyful, but it needs to be focused and thoughtful. We also want to work towards quality of craftsmanship. We don't want to be sloppy in our work. We don't want to teach our students to be lackadaisical. But we want to think about Colossians 3:17. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. We need to help them understand that they need to do their best in art, just as they do in all of their other subjects. Well, now that I've gone over some of my philosophy and my teaching, I want to get on to some practical things, and I'm really hoping that I have time to answer some questions if we can move quickly. I feel like I have to talk really fast because I have so much I want to say, but I know I can't say it all, so maybe another time I'll come back. There are many, many tips that you could learn. Instead of giving you a huge number of handouts, what I did was put some on your handout sheets so that they refer you to other places. We have lots of things for you to consider, and I'm sure that there's more that could go on that list. And if you know of more, you can always email me and I'll add your ideas to the list too. We have some practical methods, I think, based on three main points that should be approached with art lessons. One, we want to have a continuous reference to God, our creative maker. We also want to include the seven elements of art, which are line, shape, color, space, texture, value. Did I say seven of them? I get lost sometimes. Those are so critical to, at least in part, base our lessons on. And then finally, the master artists and references and examples that we give our students that will point them toward excellence. Curriculum. I have kind of an eclectic collection of lesson plans that I've put together over the years. A lot of trial and error. But I've put together some of the best of the best, and I rotate them every few years. One thing that you can do for curriculum is create your own. And when I give you the hands-on project, I'm going to show you how I did that with a simple book about elephants. You can create all kinds of projects based on the Bible and the seven design elements, all or in part, and then, again, show some masterworks. You can create a lesson fairly easily by following those points. There's also curriculum that you can buy. And I have a background in homeschooling and also used to teach privately to different homeschool families. And I discovered some curriculum that I really like. Some of it I only use here and there. I wouldn't want to just exclusively use it. But there is one that's called Artistic Pursuits that I do use exclusively for my 7th and 8th graders. I really like their middle school or junior high programs. And I divided it up into 2 years. So Artistic Pursuits for that level for me works really well. That is a secular program, but it's easily flavored with our Christian faith. So we can adapt it to our needs. And if you want to take a little break here and there and add your own lessons in, that works too. The other curriculum that I have purchased and I use quite a bit, but not exclusively, is from Barry Stebbings, How Great Thou Art. Now, I've listed about 3 different ones in your handout by Barry Stebbing, and those are all ones that I've used and I really like, but I just put those in with other lessons and use them together. Not at the same time. But those are really good resources for you if you're interested in curriculum. They actually do focus on the 7 elements of art, and they include famous artists. How Great Thou Art is strictly Christian program, where Artistic Pursuits, you have to flavor that with our faith. There's also some books, individual books by Mike Venezia, Getting to Know the World's Greatest Artist. You can use those. The Met Museum of Art has books. Most of them are titled What Makes a Van Gogh a Van Gogh or a Leonardo a Leonardo. Those are great books also. And these are books that I keep on the shelf in my classroom, and students love to just look at them. And sometimes we use them for lessons. And then you probably know, any of you that are art teachers, there are resources online for lesson plan ideas, and I listed some there. But there's a wealth of information out there. I'm just trying to help you out with some. But again, after you figured out the best of your best, put them together in annual plans and then just rotate them every maybe 3 years or so, so that you can keep things interesting with a variety. We in classical Christian education need to focus mainly on realistic style. And how many of you saw those lovely artworks that were from the contest that the ACCF held, the Bezalel contest? That was just wonderful to know that that's starting up. And I hope a lot of us start participating with student work in that. We'll have to learn more. One of the things that we need to do, along with using that realistic style that we saw out there in the foyer, we have to stick with the traditional things like portraits, landscapes, still life. And we can use examples from biblical and literary scenarios, stories, things of that nature. We can use photographs. My particular room is set up in a way that it's kind of hard to set up still life, but I do. But I rotate between actual three-dimensional still life or models sometimes, and also with photographs. The danger with photographs, though, well, I wouldn't call it a danger, I suppose. The thing that can happen there is that students' artwork will continue to become flatter. It's hard for students to see depth in photographs in the way that we want them to learn. And so don't just exclusively use photographs, but do use them. I have created a picture file, and it works really well for me. And I use page protectors so they don't get all sticky and messy. So there's an idea for you. If you have a parent volunteer, maybe you can get some help setting up a picture file. Or you could use digital images, of course, you know, projected on a screen. We tend to stray away from contemporary styles, but whatever we do, whether it's sacred or secular artwork, we want to strive for excellence because we're all about beauty, truth, and goodness in our studio classes. We need to provide excellent models and examples of art that honor God. We need to match projects with the right materials and give plenty of hands-on demonstrations. Now, before I do a hands-on demonstration, attempt to use the camera, and hopefully it'll work out well for us, let me talk just for a minute about art supplies. On the back of your handout, I've listed some of my very favorite art supplies. I love art supplies. I mean, I went to art school, and I have a studio, and I teach, and I could be dangerous in the art supply store, but I use restraint, especially with my school's budget. But I know that we always want to save money, and we're looking out for those things. But I have to say, on the other hand, if we only use cheap, inexpensive materials, it's not going to produce the joyful results that we want. And it's going to be hard for our children to strive for excellence if all we give them is cheap supplies. So if you can, negotiate with your administration for a budget that allows for some good art supplies. It's an important part of your curriculum. We use a standard size in my art room, 9 inches by 12 inches, which is what you have with your pastel paper. And I use the clear bags. You have one of those as well. And what we do is we put student work in a file. There's a box for each classroom, say 6th grade. Then I have hanging files with tabs with my students' names on them, and everyone puts their artwork, that is, if it's dry, in their file, and then it's there, either it's a finished piece or it's in progress. About twice a year, I pull all of the art out of my students' files, I put them in these clear bags, and I send them home as portfolios. And I communicate with the parents and let them know that they're on their way, they're coming, and everybody's excited. They love to get their portfolios. And I tell the students, you can't open them until you get home. You have to sit down with mom and dad and show them what you've been doing. And this works out beautifully. One of the things that the parents appreciate is that all of the art pieces are the same size, and so they can have frames on hand, and they're ready. When they bring the work home, put it in the frame, and there we go. So on the most part, I stick to 9 by 12. And it also works out really well time-wise. I don't know about you, but I teach art to each class in my school, kindergarten through 8th grade, once a week for an hour. And it doesn't seem like very much time. Not very much time at all. So a 9 by 12 is pretty realistic for them to work on, depending on the medium they're using. One or two sessions usually will do it. So that's another reason for that standard size. I absolutely love art supplies, so hopefully my tips have helped you. And if you ever have a question, contact me. My email address is, I think, in the outline pages. There, and I'll be happy to help you if I can, and you know, I'll do my best. We want people to do things like painting, drawing, printmaking, sculpting. You know, we don't want to think about fine art as a similar or the same thing as arts and crafts. Now, that's special, that's good for Sunday school or whatever, but we don't use cotton balls or coffee filters or, you know, the only time I use popsicle sticks are to dip ink for printmaking, things like that. We want to make sure that we match things up with the right medium for the right project and that we use good materials. Be sure to send home some portfolios for your students. I think you might be surprised at how excited they'll be. As far as classroom management goes, I've pretty much covered, you know, the need for thinking of this as the same as any other subject. But what I had for you on the screen was something that I actually have in my room. I am so turned around. I don't know. There we go. I got it. This is what's hanging in my room. And we use this every year. We go over it. The little children love to memorize it. And that's basically covering what I expect of them. But the class is divided between listening time, focus time where they work and they listen to music that I play, and there's no talking. And then we might, if they've earned it, because they've worked hard, I might give them maybe a 5 minutes or so period of time where they can get up and look at their friend's artwork and stretch. And actually, sometimes we do stretching before we do our artwork. But anyway, what I expect is for us to have a listening time and a focus time. And then the other things just go along with that. If I have to, I might send a student to what I call the timeout zone. I have one in my room. And we have little pink sheets of paper, depending on how old the student is, for what we would call their words of wisdom, or just a timeout zone sheet for the younger students, where they can meditate on why they're there, and they can write about it and think about it. Then they have to give it back to me, and a copy will go to the headmaster or the head of the lower school. And depending on the offense, it might go to their mom and dad, too. I send a copy of it. So usually if I get going at the beginning of the year with that, they do pretty well. I have a couple of tips for you before I do my hands-on project, and that is to think of yourself as an artist who teaches rather than a teacher that teaches art. Enrich your spirit, feed your spirit, because the more you love what you're teaching, the better you'll be, and it'll rub off on your students. Be sure that you go to art galleries and art museums, and you attend plays and concerts, and do the things that feed your spirit. Take time to make your own artwork. It's really important. I put a few books, although I know there's more out there, that might be good for you as artists to be reading. So hopefully that helps. Now I'm going to try to show you. Now my goal in this originally was that I wanted you to see how using a document projector really helps in the classroom. And I don't have a document projector, but I'm going to do my best to give you some reasons why. Do any of you have logistics in your classroom that make it hard for you to do demonstrations? Yeah, I have a room, and I'm very thankful for what I have. So thankful. We have an art room, but it's also shared space, and sometimes throughout the week it's used as a science lab. So the way the room is set up, we have lab tables, and then the other half has student tables, and I utilize the whole room as best I can. But I position myself in the middle of the room, and I have a document projector. And I found that instead of having my students all gather around me, like, well, we still do sometimes, depending on what the project is, and everyone's vying for a spot so they can see, the document projector works really well. And so this is something that I've learned to use, and I'm very thankful I have the equipment to do. I was going to just show you briefly Barry Stebbings' How Great Thou Art series for the little ones. He has a character called Wally the Worm. Have any of you ever read about Wally the Worm and you know about him? This is a great exercise for students that are learning to hold the pencil correctly and make different types of lines. So usually when I'm going to do this particular lesson, I'll have everybody warm up. We'll just take a piece of paper and a pencil and say, let's just make some different types of lines. So I might have to draw and then turn it around so you can see it. So I'll say, let's make some straight lines. Let's make some curvy lines. How about some swirls? How about different kinds of texture? You know, we'll do all kinds of things just to get moving. Let's make some thick lines, some thin lines. And, you know, we'll cover the whole page with a variety of different lines. And then I'll say, well, now that we've warmed up a little bit, let's meet Wally the Worm. Wally the Worm is a wonderful way for us to learn about lines. And so I'll show Wally in a couple of different ways. One, I'll say, well, this is Wally when he's on the go. Let's make a wavy line. Okay. I apologize. This is very challenging. And then we're going to make another parallel wavy line. And that's Wally on the go. And then Wally has a head. Okay. So we have... Is that straight? Is it? Okay. You'll have to help me. Wally is a round worm, and so we want to use contour lines to give him a little bit of depth and volume. So what we're going to do is, I say Wally has ridges. Let's make some ridges on him. So kind of make little C curvy lines, and we'll go on, we'll make Wally, and the students, they think about this really hard, and they're holding their pencils and being so thoughtful when they're doing it. And we'll go on and we'll make the whole Wally with ridges. I'm going to try to do this really quick. I shouldn't have made Wally quite so big. It wouldn't take as long. But you get the picture? Now, Wally also has a hat because he really likes to wear hats. And it's really fun because sometimes I give him different hats. You know, one of my, I think they like the fedora really well. So I just give him a nice little hat. And we're talking about lines the whole time. And there's Wally's eye, and he's usually smiling. So there's Wally on the go. And they've learned about lines. I use a projector. They can see me drawing from where they are. And we might go ahead and draw all kinds of things in the garden where Wally is. Part of the lesson would include shapes with flowers. You know, he's in the garden and he's passing by certain places. And it's adorable the way this lesson has Wally doing different things. And as the lessons progress, Wally will be crawling over steps and balls and different things, and we're teaching the student how to draw lines and control their pencil. And it's fun, and it's just very sweet. Now, the other thing that I do with it is I might show Wally asleep. Wally isn't going anywhere. Oh, there is Wally needing a diet. Sometimes Wally ends up really fat. And so we just play along with whatever happens. And, of course, I draw out his ridges. And when he's asleep, I usually give him a night hat. Okay, so that looks like Wally the Slug, doesn't it? But anyway, that's how a document projector can really help you. And when you use a regular projector, you're drawing in real time right here. You don't have to worry about turning it a certain way. It'll project up onto the screen, and it's beautiful. So I can't tell you enough how helpful that is. Now, we have a little project that I'm going to give you. And I'm hoping that I can get this all in. What I have is a book about elephants. This is just a really nice book by Steve Bloom about elephants. It's not a Christian book, but I can easily add Christ into the story. If I'm integrating this art lesson in with other subjects, it would work out beautifully with science, when you're studying mammals, or maybe you're learning about India or Africa or Asia. It just depends on what it is you would want to integrate. And you would take time to go through the book and learn about the various aspects of elephant life. But it works for art, too. I didn't go through the whole book. I have it in my room, and when we have some free time, students can go over to the bookshelf, and I like to have pictures of animals and books, big picture books with animals, all about God's creation in the art room. So this is one of the books, and what we do is we think about God's creation. We think about the seven elements of art. We choose one or more of the elements, and then we show pictures, masterworks. In our case, it's photographs of God's work. And we're going to learn about how to draw elephants. So here we are with this book. And if I had more time, I'd be going through various pages. I would be showing all of the different aspects of elephant shapes, elephants. We have a picture here that is great to demonstrate how an elephant's tail is made, how an elephant's skin has so much texture. It's so beautiful. Here's another one, elephant's skin and how textured it is. And so I bring art elements into the pictures that I show them. We also have this wonderful picture, and this is what I like to show them in this particular lesson. There you go. I think I got it, didn't I? Look at all the different shapes of elephants there are. And I tell the students, don't be afraid to draw an elephant. You know, I had a first grader last year that was sobbing at the thought of drawing an elephant. And so I went through this book with the class, and he felt so much better. Because I said, it doesn't have to be perfect, because elephants come in all different shapes and sizes, and you can't go wrong. You're going to have a great time. So we ended up drawing pictures, and I'm going to show you their student artwork before you make one, okay? Here is, can you see that? From the lesson, we came out with elephants with real personality. And I told them, you know, think about where your elephant's going to be. Is your elephant in the water? Is your elephant really old and wrinkled? This guy obviously liked the wrinkles. Is your elephant by itself, or does it have a tick bird on its back? You know, we talked about thorn trees and tick birds, and so we were able to get some conversation going in, and they were able to draw their elephants. So what I'm going to have you do is be a student. Pretend you're in kindergarten to maybe third grade. Could be maybe up to sixth grade, depending on your students. And we're going to draw an elephant. So I hope you have something that you can put your paper on that is rigid enough for you to be able to draw. I thought we would have a little bit of fun with this. So the first thing you'll do, students, is put your finger in the middle of your paper. Now, let your fingers walk two steps either to the right or to the left, depending on which way you want your elephant to face. So I went two steps to my right. Now, put a dot there. Okay, we're going to set up our space. The space is the paper that we're using. Everything that we place within the space needs to fit comfortably. And that's where the elephant's eye is. So now let's think about the elephant's head. The elephant's head can be shaped a number of different ways. And I'm just going to refer back to that picture one more time just to show you all the different kinds of elephant heads. Okay? Elephant heads aren't like other animals' heads, are they? They're kind of flat on top. And when you look at the head, I want you to think about the trunk, too. The trunk. What is your elephant doing? Is it using its trunk in a way that is helping somehow, or is it just hanging? So let's draw the top of the head and the curve around maybe where the forehead is. And let's think about the trunk. And by the way, you are using a Sharpie, right? Okay, a Sharpie. You know, some students feel like they need to use a pencil first and then go over it with Sharpie. I'll leave that up to you. I think this is a fun one to do without a pencil. So anyway, let's make the head and then let's think about the trunk. And boys and girls, when you're thinking about the trunk, just decide whether your tusks are going to be, you know, in the way, or do you want to make your tusks big and long? So you're going to have to make a break in the line for the tusks, if that's the case. Like, I'm just going to go like this because my elephant's trunk is just hanging down. And I want my tusks to have room there. So I've got a trunk on my elephant that's just kind of like that. Woo, that's kind of like that slug that I drew. But you get the picture. We have this long trunk. A lot of students like to make the trunk spraying water. You saw the one, the elephant underwater. Now, after you get the trunk, I want you to look at where the eye of your elephant is and think about the ear. Elephants have so many different types of ears. We have big fan-shaped ears. We have some that are a little bit more round. But here's some elephant ears. You see the shapes here? These are very interesting shapes. And some of them are kind of wrinkly, too. So let's draw an ear right near where the eye is. It's across from the eye. And I think I'm going to make mine kind of like a big fan, like that. And after I draw, okay, this is mine so far. After I draw that, I'm going to think about the mouth and kind of the elephant's chin, and then those tusks. And I remind the students, you know, there's a tusk on the other side too, probably. So we need to think about that. So at about this point, the students are learning that they really can do it. It's not that hard. We can look at shapes and draw shapes with our lines, contour or straight. And once we get the head, the ears, and the trunk and the tusks done, then we need to think about the back of the elephant. And I just want to go back. This one page is a real favorite of mine. You see the shapes of these elephants? As they get older, some of them get big slumped backs. You can see that curvy line here. See, when they're younger, they don't look as curved. But when they get older, they really start to show their age in that part of their body and also their belly. So when you think about the back, start thinking ahead at what their belly will be like. So I'm going to draw a back on my elephant and go off this way. And then I'm going to make it go down to the hind leg. It's always challenging to demonstrate drawing because you have to do it very quickly. And I don't know what kind of art you make, but my own art is very slowly made. So demonstrating art is challenging, but most of the students think it's wonderful, whatever it ends up being, and you don't have to feel afraid. So just put on a childlike attitude like they have. Now the back leg will lead us to the hip of this side of their body, and then their front leg is going to come down here. You see, usually when I'm drawing on the screen like this, they're drawing on their paper while they watch me, and it works out really well. I'm going to make mine an older elephant. And I'm going to put a back leg here and a front leg on the other side of its body there. But we don't want to forget about that special elephant tail, the one that we saw, actually has the hairs that go like this. And at this point, we would go into details like, do you want your elephant's toenails to show? Children, especially young children, really love to draw the elephant's toenails. Okay. And then you can also talk about texture, and that's when you can bring in the wrinkles and the baggy, saggy skin and, you know, go into a lot of detail at that point. Then the next question is, where is your elephant? Is your elephant near the water? Is your elephant out on the plain? Can you see mountains in the background? You know, you get to decide, what time of day is it? Is the elephant out in the morning? Is the sun coming up? You can add in different parts of your landscape however you wish. Is there a thorn tree nearby? And we might look at the types of trees that would be in that environment. So once you have your picture drawn with Sharpie, the next thing I'll have you do is take your two or three colors, and feel free even to trade amongst each other if you want different colors. Lightly apply a little bit of color in areas of that. But the reason this is on gray toned paper is so that you can actually let the elephant be gray and then place your color around it using that space. And that works out really well. These students, like I said, just use a minimal amount of color. And then you take your tissue and rub it very, very carefully. You don't want to get oil from your skin in that nice pastel paper. But as you can see, it ends up being just delightful. And then I gave you a clear bag so that you could actually place it in that bag and you won't smear chalk on your conference papers. And that's also another tip I have for you is those cellophane bags. I get them from clearbags.com, and they come in so many different sizes. And they have resealable adhesive on them that works really well. Well, I'm doing pretty well. Actually, I thought that I'd take up much more time than this, but I am ready for some questions and answers, if you have any. Maybe you're still drawing. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it was donated to my art room. You know, it could be done. I have an Elmo as well. But my particular projector shows exactly, you know, it's like a bird's eye view. So you would see my hand drawing, or you would see the picture that I placed under it. But anything that's three-dimensional, like a still life, it could be done, but you'd have to be very careful because you'd be looking from the top. I've never tried. Mine actually, I don't think it can. But you might be able to buy one that can adjust to that. And if you could, that would be great. Well, it loses some of the depth. And I think it's really important for us to put actual objects in front of our students. It really is. We don't want them to lose sight of how that works. But do try different things. Be creative. You can, with digital cameras, even on your iPhone. It's so nice to be able to collect images and plan things that you'll use from time to time. You have a question? Yes. 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 Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mhm. Like the younger ones. I have not used that age level of artistic pursuits yet. I am looking at it, you know, this summer, but I haven't yet. So I don't know how much technical information they give as far as drawing skills. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Uh-huh. Oh, but you'll learn with them, and that's exciting. But you might try some of the How Great Thou Art series for that age level, because that, I do know, has some drawing information in it. It helps with skill building. Yes. Yes. It is. Yeah, that's something that is very important in those foundational years. In fact, I didn't mention that all of my students, well, excuse me, I've stopped doing the younger ones. I have homework for my students. We have drawing pads, and we have drawing pad assignments every week. And that's part of their grade, is whether or not they put effort into their homework assignments. And usually the drawing pad assignment has to do with drawing something that you're looking at. And so that can help fulfill some of that for you as well, ma'am, because drawing things that they're looking at. I mean, even everyday things, like have them draw a picture of their shoe. Those are fun things to draw. Have them pull out pots and pans from the cupboard or whatever, and have them go outside. And you can assign them, if they're short on ideas, you can give them a list of things that you want them to do every week. So that helps. Yes. It goes back and forth. Now, I sometimes give a package of paper to the younger student's homeroom teacher, or, you know, their classroom teacher, and they will have the list, and students either have that assignment go on their homework sheet for the week, and mom and dad deal with it too, or sometimes the teacher gives them that work to do in the classroom at maybe a 10 or 15 minute break in whatever else they're doing. And that seems to work really well, too. And I'll give them an envelope, and they bring me their envelope, you know, with their drawings in it. But for the older students, on their supply list, I actually give them a drawing pad that they need to buy. I mean, you know, I put that on the list, and I have them date it and keep it in chronological order, keep it neat and tidy, do a good job, because we're striving for excellence. And they need to bring it in and be accountable for doing that work. By the end of the school year, they should have a book full of nice drawings. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. No, I give it back to them. I have to take a few minutes. When they're working, I'll go over and I'll check off and make sure that they did their homework. And mostly at that point, I'm just looking for effort. I'm not grading that homework assignment. I'm just making sure that they put an effort into it. And I tell them, you know, it's like if you're taking music lessons, you practice during the week. You're taking art lessons. Your parents are paying for your education, and this is part of it. Let's practice. And, you know, so that's another thing about helping students understand that art is a subject, that we need to strive for excellence in that subject. Do you have another question? Okay. Mm-hmm. They get a zero. But, you know, every week, if they did it once, then it's not going to matter. But I do have some irresponsible students. Mostly 6 through 8, but then for the packet that comes back and forth from the classroom, that's 3rd through 5th. I have done it with 1st and, you know, kindergarten through 2nd, but I didn't this year. I just felt like they were getting enough practice with their teacher in the room anyway, so it worked out. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, I do. I have containers that are shared by classrooms, and I use a brand called Yarka. They're kind of sticky paints, and they're in little pans. There's a design flaw in the case, but that doesn't matter. The paints are really good, and they work. And I give each student their own, you know, for that period. You can get 8, you can get 12, yeah. But those have been a good brand for us. I've been using them at the recommendation of the previous art teacher before me, and I have no complaints about them, so I just keep using them. But I don't use tubed watercolors at all. I do that for my own professional work, but I don't do it for my students. Okay, I use tempera paint for little ones and watercolor. And there's a product on your list of my favorite art supplies. There are watercolor crayons that we just started using. It was recommended in the Artistic Pursuits book, and they work really well for young students. They just color on their, and I give them watercolor paper. I give them a lower grade for the, Series 300 Strathmore paper, which is more student grade, and then the older students get the 400 series, which is a sturdier paper. But the watercolor crayons work really well, and then the little ones, they're learning how to control their brush and how to take care of it, so then they just get their brush wet and paint over the crayon. That's really nice. Any other questions? Yes. Now, each person has a set of 8 or set of 12 or whatever is in a pan set, and we use the lid, you know, for them for their mixing. Oh, for the water, I use yogurt containers. Oh, I actually put, I have tables of 4, and I have 2 students share a container, because they're fairly big, yeah. And if I have a parent helper, it works out really nice, but at least I will change water every once in a while for my students, because when it gets so murky, you know, that affects their color mixing, so, yeah. Well, it's 5:31. I went 1 minute over. But thank you for coming. God bless you as you go to your schools. And I do hope that I get that sheet back with contact names on it. Oh, and could I please have the Sharpies back? Yeah. You can keep everything else. Yes. Hi.
Did you say that you were teaching art 1 day a week?
Actually, well, each of my classes get it once a week.
Okay.
I teach more like 3 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what curriculum, I guess I missed it, are you using with, let's say, sit in and have the artistic pursuits for 7th and 8th?
I use that exclusively for 7th and 8th,
okay.
But I also use artistic pursuits for my little ones for 1st through 3rd grade. And I use that mostly for a whole year. It was new this year, and I really liked it. But I've added a few little things in here, too.
And what about 4 through 6?
4 through 6, I do art history quite a bit. And we use, like, the Venezia books, and we sometimes Hal Great Thou Art books. We'll have certain artists that we're learning about, and so I pull together artists. Like this year we did Leonardo, and we did Rembrandt, and I pick 3 artists for the year, maybe sometimes 4. And so they are going to actually look at models and imitate the masters. I didn't know that. We did Albrecht Dürer this year too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. It's great. Oh, I was going to tell everybody. I have names for my tables. I should have said that. They're named after artists, and they're color-coded. Like, the little ones, it's hard for them to remember the artist, and so they know that they sit at the green table. And the green table is also the Turner table, you know, or whatever. So that can be... Uh-huh.